go. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy. Day two at Netroots Nation 2019, coming to you live from the Philadelphia Convention Center. A significantly better day in Philadelphia than it was yesterday. The heavens opened. It was not always sunny in Philadelphia yesterday, not by any stretch of the imagination. Flash flood warnings, things like that. But it worked out. It worked out nicely. Chris from Germany and I wandered into Chinatown to a little dim sum place that was, well, you know, I've told you from time to time that there's only one Chinese restaurant there at home, back in the hills and hollers of almost level West by Cold Trump Juniastan. And the name of that Chinese restaurant is apt. The Chinese restaurant back home is simply called OK Chinese. And it is, you know, at best, okay Chinese. What we had last night was freaking-tastic. Little steamed pork and crab dumplings and pan-fried beef dumplings. And, oh, God. And these potato... The funny thing is, Chris ordered the... food porn. What do you want? Chris ordered these potato pancakes with, like, a little bit of ground-up meat in the middle of them. And they arrived, and I went... Hell, that's not Chinese food. That's hillbilly food. My mother made those with the leftover mashed potatoes when I was a little kid. Oh, God, they were delicious. But we've talked to a lot of interesting people, and we'll have more conversations hopefully this afternoon as folks wander by the table. We spent a lot of time recruiting yesterday. It remains to be seen. I mean, folks show up, folks don't show up. You know, one of the neatest things, and by the way, this is, the 12th day of July, 2019. One of the neatest things about coming to an event like this is the fact that it's not so much the policymakers or the bigwigs or anything like that. You might get some of those, you might not. I far prefer the conversations that arise sort of spontaneously. And in that sense, I think that's where the best information comes from, because it flows along the lines of, you know, the working theory at the horn of an extraordinary, ordinary conversation. Because the people who carry this country on their backs are the people who are the real experts. And so I've had conversations, I'll talk to anybody. And I've had fantastic discussions, and some of them will come up in conversation. I don't know, maybe others won't. But one of the things that always tickles me the most is getting to meet people that I've talked to on air, and meet them in real life. And I'm just tickled pink to have Arnold. You heard Arnold on the program calling in from time to time. Arnold works with Rick Smith. And he's Rick's producer and engineer and guy who makes things work. And, Arnold reminds me of those great engineers that I knew growing up in radio and everything, who, know individual electrons on a first-name basis, Bill, Fred, Cindy, Arnold, I'm not kidding. It is an absolute blast to finally get to meet you.
Yeah, it's really cool, Bob. One of the things when Rick said you were coming, we've talked on the air a bunch, you know, not long time listener, but listener for quite a while now. And your program is often part of our family's dinner hour, you know, hours. You know, we put it
on. Oh, you're one of the dinners I ruin from time to time.
Well, time to time. Some stuff that happens, yeah. You know, so my wife, Cheryl, will always say, thanks, Bob. And, you know, it's, you know. but, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, you get to meet people that you, like you, like it, we're radio heads. You know, this is.
Can't help doing this.
Yes. You know, and you just, you know, on the right side, which is the left side, or the you know, however you want to put it. We'll be remembered as people on the right side of history as well.
Left is right and right is wrong.
Right. There you go. What he said. But, yeah, this is absolute blast. Absolute blast meeting you. And you are the same person. And this is true of you and Rick. The people you hear on the air are who you are. And it's a blast because so many people put on their personality. They put on their character. And you're the same guy. When I was watching you do the intro just now, when you did Howdy, I always think at night, is that part of the intro? Or is that you saying Howdy? I watched you say Howdy. So that was great.
Well, yeah, but it is. I mean, it's because we want to create this idea of neighborly conversation.
Yeah, I understand. You know, and it's cool to be part of it. I mean, it's cool. You know, you come to an event like this, and you look at all the diversity and all the just the amazing a rainbow of people. And it's awesome to talk to them and listen to them. And like you said about learning, you can learn from anybody in this type of environment. I mean, everybody has something to bring to the table. You know,
pretty rare. So have you gotten I know you've spent most of your time working with Rick's broadcast and everything, but have you gotten to move around in the room a little bit and meet people?
Yeah, you know, I've interacted with a bunch of people. The other morning when Rick did the panel, it was about 2 hours. I was able to bounce around and look around, and you know, just pretty cool. I've been to a bunch of these different things, and they're always like this, where you know you go in with one idea of what's going to be, and then it's something completely different. And I live off the diversity of the people. I love to see the characters that people are, which doesn't translate necessarily on radio. I can't. Fully describe, because of my vision, for instance, what people look like necessarily, but the way that you engage with them and the way that you hear them engaging with one another, it's just awesome, you know, to have this many people of similar politic getting along and coexisting and sharing ideas. Like that conversation we had at the end of the day last night with that gentleman from Florida. I mean, that was just like out of what we were all packing up, getting out of here, and we stayed here for like 30 minutes talking to this guy about the problems of the world.
Yeah, he's going to run. He's running against Ted Yoho in Florida, and we had a fantastic conversation.
And everybody got to, you know, it was everybody's super smart, so it's like, you know, you watch. Rick talk or you talk or, you know, that gentleman, I forget his name, the gentleman, and you just go back and forth, and it's just, you know, we covered U.S. history, U.S. politics, world history, world politics.
Civics, constitutional.
it was incredible. Absolutely incredible.
Well, and I understood his point because I want impeachment as much as he does, and he wants it badly.
Yeah, well, he does, yeah.
But there's a... I don't know. I go back and forth. You know, the big news this morning is that Alex Acosta finally threw himself on his sword.
Right.
I think Julius Geezer held it for him. Yeah. Here, I'll hold the sword. You jump on it.
Right. Exactly. I'm sure that's how that went.
It's a national embarrassment. It's a national disgrace. Here's a guy talking about. You know, Trump talking about
right.
a man who is not just alleged or accused, has pled guilty to being a child sex trafficker in state court.
Right.
In the form of Epstein.
Right.
And all he can say is, I wasn't a fan. I wasn't a fan.
But there's more. Yeah,
what is, I'm sorry, is this kiddie rape or is this football? You're not a fan.
Right. Well, first of all, the whole subject is disgusting. You know, kids should mess with kids, and adults should leave kids alone in the realm of sexuality. I felt that way when I was an adolescent. I feel that way as an adult. People of similar age should mess with people of similar age. Adults should not meddle.
And maybe kids should just be allowed to be kids for a while.
Well, this is my point. You should not meddle as an adult with adult concepts and ideas in the world of children. As far as...
Yeah.
I don't know what that was, but where was I?
Well, no, just Epstein in general, and the national embarrassment, impeachment, and I'm seeing a lot of people. There's a lot of impeachment talk going on here in this group.
Yeah, but
among these people,
if we impeach him, we empower him.
That's my fear.
And the more I analyze it, the more I come to this, where all you're going to do is make him look good. You're trying to make him look bad.
The bottom line is that the maggots. He was right. He could shoot somebody in the middle of Fifth Avenue and not lose a vote among the maggots.
They'll make him cool. It'll make him cool.
But the next question then becomes: do we want to make sure that he just stays isolated among the maggots, or do we want to run the risk of? Of bringing more people to his side because he's some poor persecuted. No.
I worry about that. Like, okay, so what I think will happen is if he was a Democrat, which he's not, but if he was, everything that we find objectionable would have been an impeachable offense. The way he talks, the way he reads, the thing about the airplanes during the Revolutionary War, anything would have been an impeachable offense. Now we have a criminal as a president, and we can't...
And nothing is an impeachable offense.
Nothing. And the Republicans, are, you know, talk about falling on their sword. You know, you have an entire Senate, you know, Republican-controlled Senate that's like, hey, we'll just all get on the sword. It's fine.
You know, I was thinking about this the other day, Arm. I think we need to give a new name to every Republican member of the Senate.
All right.
You know how you put a nickname between the first name and the last
Enabler?
Name? No. No. We're just going to call all Republican senators Stormy.
Stormy?
Yeah. Lindsey Stormy Graham, Mitch Stormy McConnell, because they're all doing for Donald Trump what Stormy Daniels did for Donald Trump.
Yes.
So I think going forward, Stormy.
Stormy. Well, yeah. I'm
Stormy
I'm,
McConnell, you know, Stormy Cornyn.
I don't know how we get out of the situation. I mean, people are talking about, you know, not having an election, having an election, but he won't. Step down. My thing is, because his instability, he's capable of anything. And because of some of the framework that we've allowed to become law with the presidential powers, I always want to say NAA, but it's the other acronym that they passed under Obama, where, you know, he can have a national emergency, he can mobilize, you know, the military and kill the internet and do all this stuff because he feels like it, is a scary proposition with a person like Trump. Now, you know, it was scary to have that framework under Obama, but I think everybody kind of felt, everybody on our side kind of felt safe, comfortable that he was... you know, not going to do anything nuts. And if he had to use those powers, it was because it was actually required.
Yeah, because something had gone desperately wrong.
Desperately wrong. Not that it was a political act.
Well, now something's gone desperately wrong, and there's nobody can do anything about it.
Well, this is the question that I have for you. When you say nothing can be, something has to be done about it.
I'm not convinced because I think, I've poured a lot of time into thinking about this. All systems have a built-in flaw where, under the right set of circumstances, a system can be proven to be it can be reduced to chaos and ineffectiveness. And I think, in the form of Donald Trump, we have finally and the thing is, the framers knew he was out there. They knew he was out in the future. And they tried to build safeguards against him. And we finally found him, and all the safeguards they put in don't work. And that is why that's why I keep saying and hammering and hammering and hammering.
We've been in constitutional crisis since
January 20, 2017.
It's not that they don't work. It's that they are intentionally not being utilized.
Well, but if they're not used, they don't work.
Well, fair enough. For instance, I'm being, just so everybody knows why I can't think, someone's talking over my shoulder.
Yeah, don't complain. It's the boss. Well, it's Arnold, it's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you.
Absolutely, Bob.
Both on air and off air, and I enjoyed hanging out with you last night.
It was great to meet you in person, and like I said before at the beginning of the interview, you know, you're like the same guy off air. It's so cool. So, awesome.
Well, thank you so much, man. We'll talk more, but I hope there's another opportunity to get together down the road.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Arnold. Take care. So we're going to just keep plugging along and see who comes along next. Got a couple of stories to tell. There are always stories to tell. And that's kind of what I've got in mind for what we've got for the remainder of the day. All right? All right. So the way I look at it, if you fly a few thousand miles to get here, it would be a disservice on my part not to let people hear a voice that it goes with a name that they hear a lot. Chris from Germany came here to see what a Netroots Nation looks like, and I have her across the table from me at the microphone. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Bob, and hi, the community.
Yes. Everybody knows who hears the thank yous and the challenges that you are a stalwart supporter of the community. And let me just start, because I've got an opportunity to thank you face-to-face. Thank you for all of that.
I'm honored to do so, Bob.
And so let me ask you, what do you think? Don't hold back. Be candid.
Where the hell are the candidates? We have 11 years to clean up our act, or the ability of the planet to support life goes a frickin' way. Where are the candidates? The election is next year. Some elections, of course, are this year.
And
the engine that I see as being effective about imposing sanity on this frickin' country, where is it?
I mean, I think there's a lot of people of goodwill here.
I agree.
But these are a bunch of, this is...
dilettantes.
Well, that and cat herding and butterfly wrangling.
Yes. And sparkle fart pony brigade corralling. Yeah. Good luck with that.
I mean, you took a look at today's schedule of events. You're right. I see. Okay. Time out. The evenings, okay, you said, where are the candidates? Well, at least we've got some meaningful politicians. Part of the Democratic House,
and
part of the Democratic Senate. This afternoon's keynote will be Pramila Jayapal, Ayanna Pressley, Jeff Merkley, and some other folks. And they'll be good to hear from.
Yes.
I have a particular degree of respect for Pramila Jayapal simply because I like her Medicare for All bill.
She's been very good in a short time. I also like Senator Merkley.
I do as well. Unfortunately, he's hamstrung by virtue of
the Senate and McConnell.
But when you say where are the candidates, you mean where are any of the 22 or 23 people that purport to be running for president?
And local candidates. Because if we get the presidency, We've been seduced by the fallacy that the presidency is enough.
Right.
We've been seduced by that fallacy for years, and look where it got us. We lost the states. We have to have the states. And my question is, the election is not 20 years from now. The election is next year. Time is late.
The first primary is in 6 months.
Exactly.
Yeah. And what's kind of weird is that last year in New Orleans, Cory Booker was here, Kamala Harris was here, and so was Elizabeth Warren.
Exactly.
And Bupkis. I don't know if there's something else, some other candidate forum going on somewhere, or if it's harder to get them because everybody and their cousin are in Iowa or South Carolina.
If there were another forum, you'd think it would be somewhere in the news if the forum were big enough and significant enough to corral presidential candidates. I haven't seen anything. To my knowledge, this is the only thing going.
That's the other thing that's kind of surprising. There aren't even, like in the exhibit hall, you and I have both walked through there trying to recruit some guests, because there's a lot of people with a lot of interesting issues that I would love to share with the community. Did you see even one booth for even one presidential candidate?
Or a senatorial candidate?
Yeah.
Or a congressional candidate?
Not there.
Nothing.
Not there.
And it's shocking, because, again, the Republicans are evil frickin' bastards, and we know that. But they're frickin' effective.
Yeah.
We're not even showing up, let alone being beaten on the field.
And, you know, there's that old saying that showing up is half the battle.
Yeah, exactly.
And we're not engaged. I did notice, okay, I take it back. I saw one table in there in the exhibit hall. Virginia is one of those weird states that elects in the odd numbered years.
It's the state I vote in, Bob.
And so... Virginia House Democrats do have a table in there.
Good. Excellent.
But, you know, trying to get somebody to come and the funny thing is, I'm looking up and down Radio Row here. It's not just us. I mean, I bathed and put on cologne and deodorant and everything this morning.
It seems like the other people who are staffing the Row have done the same thing. Yeah. But I'm looking at a whole bunch of empty space.
Yeah, it's been this way for 2 days. I was trying to count. Let's see. Pittsburgh, Minneapolis, Las Vegas, New Orleans, this. So this is at least my fifth one of these. And I have never seen it so ill attended. I mean, that's not to say there's nobody here.
But not a lot.
But there's not a lot, and you know, people are in sessions, and that's cool too. But there's not a lot. I'm shocked at the lack of engagement.
So am I. And again, it's next year is do or die. It's not an inconsequential, trivial election. It's everything.
Now I'm looking at the schedule here. Taking Trump to court and winning, what it means to be aggressive in the fight to protect democracy. It seems interesting.
But how do you counteract the fact that Trump has the Supreme Court in his pocket?
Right, and so that has to be, you know, that's the elephant in the room.
Yeah. Same thing with a lot of proposals, like getting the House to pass them. They're passing them and dying in the Senate.
The one that jumped off the page and kind of made me laugh, Chris: the role of progressive media in 2018 and 2020. That is that's a panel that's going to be taking place at 1:30.
Mm-hmm.
I'm almost tempted to
go.
Yeah,
I think we should.
You know, being how, you know, we are that.
Yes, and especially considering the fact that the mainstream media is currently repeating the same mistakes that they made in 2015 and 2016. And, of course, in the elections before that. So the game is already afoot. I think it'd be very interesting.
And, you know, it reminds you, say they're repeating the same old garbage. You know, you're back in the U.S. for a few days. So if you turn the TV on, you get a chance to engage in my filthy little morning habit, you know, over there on
MSNBC. I'm sorry, Bob. I slept through it today.
Good for you. I'm proud.
I needed to.
But the thing is, yesterday when I got up, I heard, and it just it made me bark. I heard Joe Scarborough say the same thing that I heard Bishop Willard Romney say in 2012. And this was by way of excoriating the Democratic presidential candidates for raising their hands and saying they would have, they'd let them illegal immigrants have all the health care they wanted till there wasn't none left for none of the white people.
There's a finite thing.
And so what you what he said was that, well, you know, if an undocumented immigrant gets hurt, they can go to the hospital. Any ER in the country has to treat you when you go to the ER. That's the law of this nation. And, you know, it was just further proof of the distance.
Disconnection from reality.
Disconnection from working and uninsured people's.
I have a question.
Yes.
If an undocumented immigrant gets a highly effective, highly contagious disease, such if he goes to the hospital and infects the staff, and by the way, he's already been exposed to a lot of people on the way to the hospital, how exactly does that keep America safe? If he isn't treated and the contagion isolated and then eliminated, how exactly are we safer?
Right, and that's the thing. If you walk in, I know it because I've seen it over the course of Agnes and me raising four kids and ourselves. There's a sign, a big bold sign in red with white letters on the wall of the ER at my little hospital. It says, "We are required to stabilize you." You know, we are not required to ameliorate. We are not required to cure. We are not required to fix. And what stabilize means is you sit in a room, they come and they look at you, and if you are not at death's door, they send you home. And sometimes if you're death's door, they send you home.
To infect others along the way.
Yeah, or, you know, heart disease or diabetes.
It's unconscionable. This is a so-called Christian nation, and we're turning people out to die for Jesus' sake.
Well, you know, he suffered too. But it made me crazy because, you know, I have that real-world experience. Joe Scarborough does not. And the thing is, Chris, he said it in conversation with Senator Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota. And she said, "Well, yes, that's absolutely correct."
I'm never backing her.
It was a shameful lie. And she didn't even have an, you know, for
it's
as
also pandering to the Republicans on their ground.
Yeah, absolutely.
What our party has been doing ever since we got scared shitless by Ronald Reagan.
And once again, yeah, it all goes back to January the 20th, 1981.
Indeed.
But,
I don't see how in the world we restore sanity when our candidates, the reasonable ones, have already given in to Republicans on their grounds of, tax cuts and
deficit. But the thing is,
Klobuchar
is supposed to be this hyper-competent, you know,
and she's given up already.
And she's conceding points based on things that she doesn't even know.
Exactly. And has no experience of. But in the meantime, it's life and death questions for millions of people.
Exactly.
I just find it that our people are willing to pronounce, to give up the fight, don't know what they're talking about, don't know what the stakes are, not really. They can appear to be reasonable in Republican eyes, and the Republicans will demonize them anyway. It's a fool's errand. I just don't see how we come out of this fight winning. And if we don't win, that's it. That's the ballgame. We have how many months until November 2020, and also then to fight the various challenges that will happen? How many? We have
16 months.
We have 16 months, and if I look around here, I wouldn't know there was a campaign going on at all anywhere in the country. It just is complete. It's in its own little
bubble. It really
is
kind of breathtaking, isn't it?
It is. I'm shocked because I've never been to Netroots before, but it was my impression because I read Daily Coast and I read the various liberal sites. That there was actually a political element to it, that candidates would appear. And I just, I don't see it. I don't see it at all. Now, maybe there's better stuff going on in the sessions. I don't know. But looking at the list of sessions, it doesn't seem to have a real political angle. And
no.
And politics is the way we get out of this mess. Expressing nice sentiments won't. We have, of course, we have to change consciousness.
Yeah, I don't even see the kumbaya singing going on, and metaphorically speaking,
no, exactly.
Of course. There's just a tremendous sense of disconnection.
So, I mean, one of the questions I have, I don't know why this is the case. Maybe our side has given up. We're tired of being angry to no purpose, to no end, as it seems. I don't know, but it seems like we're vanishing,
even
escaping into our
even
own
Even the bubble. Non-traditional candidates. Where's Andrew Yang? You know, why isn't Marianne Williamson sitting there with a crystal? And I mean, I'm being a smartass.
This is their chance to maybe gain some ground.
Why are progressives so star-spangled, ignorable? I mean, is it just a matter of they don't have to come here because they're running in primaries, right?
I don't know anymore.
I'm flabbergasted and pretty well flummoxed. But Chris. I'm having a blast running around town with you. We had a fantastic little dinner last night.
Oh yeah, Chinatown rocks.
Oh,
can't get that in Germany.
No good Chinese in Germany.
Not like that. You have passable.
Is it like
Chinese? But of course, I've not been to Berlin.
Is it like me when I'm at home? It's okay Chinese.
I'd say so. Except again, there's like in Berlin, you have a terrific food scene. I have not been to a Chinese restaurant yet in Berlin. So that might be better. There might be pockets. But in Stuttgart, it has much better ethnic food than I thought it would have when I arrived there 15, 16 years ago. It's getting better. But I came out of the D.C. area, man.
Yeah.
And so last night was lovely. Also doing the Starbucks Odyssey is lovely.
we're back on the Starbucks trail. Well, Chris, thank you so much for taking a few minutes for this conversation. I know people are tickled to hear from you.
Oh, it's my pleasure and honor.
And we'll see where the rest of the weekend takes us.
Let's win, and if we stand together, we win. Thanks, Tara.
United, exactly. Thanks, Tara. United we stand. We can stand together or hang separately. Wasn't that the line?
That's it.
All right. Chris, thanks so much.
Certainly. Bye-bye.
Like I said, I've been reconnoitering the exhibit hall, and there's a lot of interesting and compelling organizations exhibiting in there. And I saw a banner yesterday, and I reached out in hopes that we would have a further conversation about the issue that the Humane League works on. Frankly, I confess it was a new organization to hear of. So I'm joined now by John Camp. He's the vice president for grassroots of the Humane League. That's thehumaneleague.org. John, again, thank you very kindly for taking time to talk to us here on the Horn. Tell us about your group's mission.
Yeah, so we are a nonprofit, and we exist to end the abuse of animals raised for food. And we do that by creating institutional change for farm animals, really two main ways. One is we work with corporations to adopt better animal welfare policies, banning the worst abuses from their supply chain. So for right now, we're working on a comprehensive chicken welfare policy, and we've got 130 companies to sign on to that, including Burger King, Subway, etc. And now we're focusing on McDonald's to do the same. And then we also work through ballot initiatives where we mobilize grassroots activists associated with ballot initiatives to ban some of the worst abuses in states. So, for example, in 2016, we assisted with question 3 to ban gestation crates for mother pigs, veal crates for veal calves, and battery cages for egg-laying hens, and also the sale of products from such practices. And then we did the same thing in 2018. We assisted with Proposition 12, which did the same in California.
And that was that. So, two questions. First,
sure.
can you talk a little bit about, because you know when you go through the drive-through,
yeah,
wherever, you're not necessarily thinking about where it came from.
Sure.
You know, most people think that food comes from the grocery store.
That's right.
You're working to change that. So question one is, what can you detail some of the abuses that you work on? And then question two, you mentioned California. Do you focus on particular states, or is this something that's happening in virtually every state?
It's a great question. So for starters, our main focus right now is on the abuse of chickens. So chickens suffer in the largest numbers in the United States. So in the U.S. every year, about 9 to 10 billion animals are raised and killed for food, and over 90% of those are chickens. So we focus on chickens primarily just because they're the least regulated. They're the least... they have the least protections, and then also just the largest numbers. To just detail one abuse that we focused on was the battery cage for egg-laying hens. And these are these small wire mesh cages that confine egg-laying hens, about 4 to 6 of them per cage. And each hen has the total living space about the size of an iPad. So these hens can't stretch their wings, they can't move around, and they live like that for about 18 months until they're killed. So it's just intense confinement of kind of unrelenting.
Why is it called a battery cage?
That is a good question. It's.
I mean, is there a battery attached, or is it because they're done in like batteries?
That's the latter. And,
okay.
And so that's one of the worst abuses. The good thing is that as a result of our corporate commitments that we've been doing over the last half decade or so, pretty much every major food purchaser in the United States has made a commitment to move away from this cage. So that's an example of what the Humane League's doing, which is working on one cruel practice at a time, going company by company. Once we get a commitment from one company, we go to the next company, say, your competitor has done this, why haven't you? And slowly but surely, the domino effect happens, and we're able to incrementally phase out some of the cruelest confinement practices.
Is there an imposition of more cost that's associated with this?
There is at first. That said, as more and more companies do this, it becomes less costly per company, because now you can work at a larger scale. It's literally pennies for the cost that there is. It's pennies per egg, and we think that that cost is not worth the suffering that comes.
So you said 130 companies have signed on to this campaign.
So that's right now for our chicken welfare for chickens raised and killed for meat. So there are two different types of breeds of chickens. One are those for use for eggs, and that was our focus over the last few years. And now we move that battle to a global scale, where we're getting companies to adopt global welfare policies. In the United States, we're focusing on chickens raised for meat. And so what we're doing, we're asking for three things from companies. One is to provide a better living environment for these animals on the factory farms. The second is to move to a more humane method of death. So instead of live shackle slaughter, moving to a system where animals are humanely gassed at the end, which it's still not ideal, but it's a big step forward. And then the final deals with their genetics, and that right now chickens grow about 5 times faster than they did just 6 decades ago. So to put that in perspective, if you're a 150-pound human, now you weigh 750 pounds, but with the same lungs, the same skeletal structure, the same limbs, that were meant for a smaller body. And so that causes these chickens to suffer. So we're urging companies to move to better welfare breeds for these chickens so they don't grow so fast.
And so when people, these are mostly companies that are servicing restaurant chains, fast food chains. Does it also encompass producers for the grocery store?
Yeah, so for example, for our battery cage commitments, we went grocery store at a time. So we start one sector at a time. We started with food service companies, then we went to restaurants, and then we went to grocery chains. So, for example, for the battery cage commitment, we're talking about Walmart, we're talking about Safeway, talking about
Kroger,
yeah. Giant, et cetera.
Okay.
So, yeah. And then... right now what we're doing with the chicken welfare for chickens raised for meat is we're in the stage right now where we're focusing on the restaurants. And once we get the key restaurants on board, we'll move to the retailers.
So for people who are going through the drive-through, can you, John, can you tell us who a few of the chains are that are getting it right?
The restaurant chains right now that are a step above, say, McDonald's, and who have are the early adopters of these welfare standards. We're talking about Burger King. We're talking about Subway. We're talking about Chipotle. Those are some of the early adopters.
I have a Popeyes problem. I love Popeyes because, among other things, we don't have one of those where I live in West Virginia. Where are they? Have you?
To the best of my knowledge, they have not signed on to that yet.
Okay.
Yeah.
They'll hear from you.
They will at some
KFC,
point. KFC is not yet. They will at some point, but right now we're going after McDonald's for the main reason is that McDonald's is responsible for about 5% of all chicken meat purchased in the United States, and that means about 350 million chickens they're responsible for every single year. And then McDonald's is also, when we think of a company that represents fast food, McDonald's has the cultural sway that when McDonald's,
if they do it, if that domino falls, the rest will fall behind.
That's exactly right, and we saw that with battery cages and also gestation crates, which is a cruel confinement for mother pigs. We saw that when McDonald's adopted those policies. Other companies did as well. And so that's why it's crucial for us to get McDonald's on board for our chicken welfare commitment.
I eat a lot of chicken, and this is going to change the way that I approach that.
Appreciate that.
Let me ask you the hard question.
Yeah.
You eat chicken?
I do not. So I am a 21-year vegan.
Wow.
And so far, so good. Just ran a half marathon last year. And
I was going to say, you don't look like you're going to faint or anything.
Yeah, so far so good for the vegan lifestyle, and I think for anyone wanting to explore that, it doesn't have to be an all or nothing thing. That even opting for more vegan options is a good way to experiment with it and see which foods work for people.
Just talking on that topic, I trust you saw the story out of Mississippi a few days ago
about the
labeling.
That basically what they're doing is they've made it illegal to label veggie as a burger. So instead it would be a veggie patty. And I think they're feeling the pressure that animal agriculture is seeing, that no longer are these burgers a fringe item, that they're being adopted by companies like Burger King, who now is the Impossible Whopper, or Carl's Jr., who now offer Beyond.
Yeah, you know, that thing wasn't terrible. I tried it. It was satisfying.
The Impossible Whopper?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh. I've said for a long time on the program that it feels to me like the I guess we could call them big meat, are doing everything in their power to take a meat eater like me and turn me vegan. Because it becomes an ethical and moral challenge when you know a little bit about the production processes. Let me ask you this, John. When we talk about an end to the battery cages and so forth, is there a way to feed a hungry world that still wants to eat meat that doesn't involve so much brutality? Because whether it's a CAFO with beef, or whether it's the godforsaken slaughter operations for pigs in places like Tar Heel, North Carolina, or the chicken production places that dot much of the South, obviously the reason they came up with this is because they were trying to maximize profit with no real concern for the well-being of the living creatures.
That's right.
Is there a way to produce these things where it can be, in the words that your organization uses, humane? And what does humane mean?
That's a good question. So for starters, I think there are a few approaches. One, we as a world do eat too much meat. you know, it's in the affluent countries where we can eat so much meat, and it's an inefficient process in that we're taking all these calories, funneling it into an animal. So many of these calories don't convert to edible flesh. It just goes to the animal breathing or creating hair or bones.
Sure.
So I think for starters, it would be wise as a society for us to eat significantly less meat. I think we're going to see more and more plant-based alternatives that taste better. So you know, you said the Impossible Burger for you is tolerable. I think next year the Impossible Burger is going to be even more tolerable for you. It's something that we're only getting better at, of creating plant-based substitutes. I think someday we'll see clean meat, which is meat grown from the cells of an animal and not the actual animal. That's probably decades until
right,
that's
right.
marketable or on a mass scale. So I think, and then I think we need to keep urging companies to adopt more humane standards. So I think that two questions. Yes, I think we can do a lot better in the here and now, but I think we as a society do need to eat less meat as a whole.
Well, let me ask you this in closing then.
Yeah.
With the work that you're doing, is there activism that people out there in the wide world can engage in if they wish to be supportive of your mission?
Absolutely. I appreciate you asking. So for starters, for these corporate campaigns that we run, a lot of these companies don't adopt, some do out of the goodness of their heart, but there are a lot of these companies that adopt these policies out of pressure. So our campaigns that we run against these companies, We need help in two ways. One is on the ground. So, for example, against McDonald's, we have campaign actions in the heart of McDonald's land, which is in Chicago, but then also throughout the country doing grassroots actions like protests and leafleting and stuff like that. So we could definitely use volunteers for that. And letter writing to McDonald's executives.
But social then, media, Facebook,
social
Twitter,
media,
Instagram.
Facebook, and then we also have what's called our Fast Action Network, where a couple times a week individuals receive an email from us saying, hey, here's the steps we need, and it could be email Steve Easterbrook, the CEO of McDonald's, to let them know. So individuals can go to thehumaneleague.org and either sign up to be on-the-ground activists with us, what we call change makers, or to take part in our Fast Action Network, or best of all, both. And then finally, you know, we always accept donations, which lead to
sure.
us being able to do more good for our work.
So, okay, one last question.
Please.
Was there a little bit of a play on when? How long has the organization been around? And was there a little bit of a play on words with the?
That's so funny. We've been asked if we, you know, first people often say, oh, the Human League. And I think the founder of the Humane League was oblivious to the Human League. So I think it was somebody who wasn't super in the loop with pop culture references, maybe, especially 80s pop culture references.
Well, I was just thinking here a little parody video of Don't You Cage Me, Baby might work really, really well.
That's good. It's definitely an inside joke within the Humane League.
Okay.
And hopefully at some point the Humane League will be better known than the Human League. I think right now we do have more Facebook followers.
And where are you headquartered?
We're originally based in Philadelphia, and now we're a remote organization, but the mail comes into the D.C. area.
Okay.
But we've got about inching towards 90 employees spread out throughout the world, and the remote thing works, and we're able to reach a larger population due to having activists spread out throughout the world.
Well, John, thank you very, very kindly.
Thank you, Bob.
And thank you for coming by, and I wish you the very best in your ongoing work.
Appreciate it. Likewise.
Take care.
You too.
John Camp, Vice President, Grassroots of thehumaneleague.org. John Allen Gay is the executive director of the John Quincy Adams Society, another one of the groups that I ran across in the exhibit hall as I was foraging for conversations yesterday. I saw John Quincy Adams, and my little ears perked up because, well, you don't hear a lot about John Quincy Adams. So I stopped, and we started a conversation, and I invited them to come over and talk with us a little bit. So, John, or do you prefer Alan? Okay, well, John, Welcome, first of all, to the Horn, and thank you for dropping by. Your organization is foreign policy focused. Why did you select John Quincy Adams as your avatar?
Yeah, well, you know, if you look back at a speech he gave in 1821 when he was Secretary of State, he talked about how America goes not abroad in search of monsters to destroy. You know, he was arguing for a foreign policy in which the way we realize our values is not driven by force. That, you know, the purpose of our foreign, our national security policy is to defend the United States, but when we want to see our values realized abroad, we're not going to go invading other countries and trying to force them to become democratic. We're not going to be getting into wars. At the time, it was with European powers over what their internal political characteristics are. It was very focused on that vision of restraint.
And I take it from our brief conversation, you feel that we have lost our way relative to that restraint?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And I think it was a very long process. I think in the post-Cold War era, it's been particularly acute. You know, we've pretty much been at war constantly. If you talk to Air Force people, since they were doing the no-fly zone over Iraq, they'll say they've been at war for 27 years. And, you know, we've gotten into a lot of these conflicts that haven't seemed to make the United States safer, haven't been good for the people in the region often, and have come at tremendous expense. You know, you talk about the Iraq War, for example, you know, which was a complete unforced error and actually made us significantly less safe. This was to the tune of $5 to $6 trillion, according to some estimates, with some of the spending still to happen. So these are huge costs. And even if you're focused on domestic issues, this stuff ends up wrecking a lot of your domestic initiatives because it takes up all the energy.
And sucks all the oxygen out of the room. You mentioned Iraq, and I know you have written in the past on Iran. Is it me, or does it seem like there is a striking similarity between the run-up to the invasion of Iraq and what we're witnessing now relative to Iran?
Absolutely, and it sometimes feels like certain officials within the Trump administration, especially National Security Advisor Bolton and Secretary of State Pompeo, have been trying to sell something to the American people. I think their view is that they aren't actually trying to start a war, but they don't understand the danger that the maximum pressure strategy could pose of a war starting. It's creating a very dangerous context that is ripe for miscalculation and misinterpretation. It could get very bad very quickly.
And if something happens, it will be a very different war compared to what Iraq was, will it not?
Yeah. I mean, for example, if we put boots on the ground, Iran has about 2.5-3 times the population of Iraq. It's much more difficult terrain. You know, Iraq is open desert, which for military purposes is fairly easy to work with. Iran is very mountainous, and the core parts of Iran are far away from the coastline. The beaches aren't very good for landing, so are you going to be running your supply lines through areas of Iraq that Iran has a lot of influence in? Are you going to be running them through southern Pakistan where, you know, there's a lot of separatism? Are you going to be running through Afghanistan? So even just to get there would be exceedingly difficult. So it would be really ugly.
As a student of history, I've argued on a number of occasions that the long arc of history tells us that marching into that region and trying to impose one's will is a fool's errand. And the only person who ever did it remotely successfully was Alexander the Great. And I argue that if you look around the Pentagon or through the Joint Chiefs, we're fresh out of Alexander the Great. And so is it a lack of foresight, a lack of understanding, a lack of adequate training and education, or is it just the hidebound mentality of Washington, D.C. that makes us wind up in these places?
I think it's a lack of humility is what it boils down to. It's not like it was rocket science to realize ahead of time that Iraq had a lot of risks to it. you know, people knew it was a deeply divided country, that it had been suffering under sanctions and corruption and autocracy for many years, you know, that this was not a ripe place to go in and have stability and, you know, establish a democracy. So ultimately, we need to be more humble about what we can accomplish, and we need to be more humble about what military force can accomplish. It's a very hard-to-use tool.
And when we talk foreign policy, I think it is one of the tragedies of our era that we automatically assume that this is, you know, it's like Mao, you know, politics practiced at the muzzle of a gun. Mm-hmm. So we assume that we're talking about military involvement. But the Department of State itself, as opposed to the Pentagon, can be every bit as pernicious insofar as we use our foreign policy to advance, for instance, corporate corporate interests that wind up being hateful and violent for the people in the countries where we're trying to make that country safe, not for democracy, but for, back in the early part of the last century, United Fruit.
Sure. Yeah.
So, can you talk a little bit about American foreign policy being twisted to serve a corporate agenda?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think that there are a lot of narrow and private interests that want U.S. foreign policy to do their beck and call. You know, for one example, the think tank community in Washington is, it's well known that it receives a lot of funding from defense contractors.
And you actually come out of that community, do you know it?
Yes, yeah. And, you know, it's a, there's a lot of good that's done by think tanks, but there's also some questions around the funding that I think need to be addressed much more fully. And also foreign governments are big funders of think tanks, and those governments are often trying to get the United States to do stuff for them.
Well, we talked yesterday, and perhaps you might expand a little bit, please, on, for instance, Michael Flynn and the effort by Turkey to influence our foreign policy.
Yeah, well, and if you look at it, you know, people worry about Russian influence, but actually a lot of the influence that's happening in our political system is coming from countries like the United Arab Emirates, like Saudi Arabia, that are funding a lot of former officials to give remarks, you know, give speeches, produce reports that end up being quite favorable to these countries' interests. And it's quite remarkable because these are countries that with which we have very little in common. Besides, I guess we both love money a lot.
Or arguably should be adversarial toward.
Yeah,
I think about the client list of Paul Manafort. Mm-hmm. Every bloodthirsty, brutal dictator in the world, it seemed at one point, was hiring his lobbying firm to get some sort of favorable or preferential treatment out of the United States. What does it mean, John, when one of these hateful tyrannies gets favorable treatment from the United States? What does favorable treatment for a dictatorship mean?
Well, sometimes it can be arms sales. In the case of the UAE and Saudi Arabia, it's much more about broader support. It includes weapons. It includes a lot of political support, taking pressure off of them, not squeezing them as hard as we might when they do stuff like chop up a journalist in their consulate in Istanbul. You know, there are a lot of things where we're giving them much more leeway and giving them the benefit of the doubt in a way that we really shouldn't be. And, you know, we're ultimately behaving as though we expect them to be a kind of permanent friend to us. And, you know, Lord Palmerston said that nations don't have permanent allies or enemies. They only have permanent interests. And I think that in the Middle East, that should be especially clear to us, that we don't really have those kinds of deep friendships around the Persian Gulf where there's just deep roots that we can build on.
Yeah, we don't have drinking buddies.
No.
And but to be fair, as repulsive as our relationship is with, for instance, Saudi Arabia right now, John, it's not like in the last administration they had the Saudis' arms behind, pulled behind their back and were frog marching them anywhere. What would it take to get this country to fully and finally realize that those really aren't our friends, and that we don't have friends, as you've noted. For instance, would shifting to a clean, green, sustainable, renewable energy infrastructure so that we could finally look at Saudi Arabia and say bye-bye, is there anything like that in our future?
I think it's certainly possible. We've already seen a reduced U.S. reliance on oil from the Middle East. And that, you know, to be perfectly blunt, that's the interest in the Persian Gulf that we have that can actually be a pocketbook issue for ordinary Americans, that can actually seriously affect the global economy. So I don't want to downplay that, but at the same time, the ability of the market to deal with disruptions in some of these supplies, which that's ultimately what we're afraid of, is that one country will, say, take over the region, or that Iran will cut the Strait of Hormuz. Oftentimes, it isn't as well grounded in military and economic reality as people realize.
So we've talked a lot about the Middle East, but our foreign policy boondoggles also have a profound effect here in our own hemisphere. Talk a little bit about American foreign policy vis-a-vis, say, Venezuela.
Yeah, well, I don't think it's been helpful, and it's been highly unusual for us to be taking a position on who ought to be governing a country when that person doesn't actually govern that country in effect, you know, that de facto Guaido is not the president of Venezuela. He does not control the armed forces. You know, he does not control a lot of the political apparatus, a lot of the distribution of resources. You know, we might like it if he were president over Maduro, but that doesn't reflect the reality on the ground. And we also didn't put enough oomph behind that to actually make that reality change. So you end up with alienating our ability to potentially serve as a mediator. I think Maduro probably would have preferred a different country be a mediator, but still, it's harming our ability to do any good in this very difficult situation, and it's really hamstringing our diplomacy to say we're going to deal with this guy and not that guy.
Why does it seem that the United States, particularly in the Western Hemisphere, always defaults to the right-wing autocrat, the proto-fascist, the Pinochets of the world?
I think a lot of it is related to some of the legacies of the Cold War. You know, at that point, there was a geostrategic competition.
But we were doing this in Nicaragua in 1900 before there was a communist threat.
Yeah, well, and there were a lot of economic interests at play as well. Mm-hmm. You know, there's I think that's definitely a factor, too, you know, that the perception that U.S. foreign policy ought to be at the service of a particular private business or something like that, rather than serving the general public interest and also trying not to cause harm to other countries and respecting their sovereignty.
So, you know, the name of your organization is, again, the John Quincy Adams Society. Relatively contemporaneous with him, we also have James Monroe. Is there an argument to be made that one of the long-term mistakes, is the evolution of the Monroe Doctrine in the Western Hemisphere?
Yeah, well, I think the key word there is evolution, because you can go back and read the original speech where Monroe laid out the Monroe Doctrine, and it is very different from what we've seen for example in the early 20th century. In practice, that was an evolution away from the roots of the doctrine. The doctrine was about excluding European interference in Latin America. It was about excluding...
So that they could be self-determinative.
Yes, yeah, and that's what was happening. And it was actually John Quincy Adams who was central in writing the Monroe Doctrine, since he was Secretary of State at the time. And, you know, he was arguing that this is a way for us to better advance our values in the region, but also that it's consistent with our interests. It was about avoiding conflict with these European powers, but also saying, hey, you can't come over here and start kicking people around in our region, because that's where it would start to also really threaten the United States. You know, so I think there was a self-interest in this as well.
So we start out with something that could even marginally be called, at least marginally, benign, and it has morphed over time into some sort of muscular butch. We're gonna run this hemisphere, whether you like it or not.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's become much more offensive to the sovereignty of Latin American states in this new form, because it's much more interested in their internal politics, in their financial arrangements, in things that have nothing to do with their relations with powers from outside of our hemisphere. It was really, there were no real restrictions that were being placed on Latin American countries by the Monroe Doctrine as it was written.
So I think of what, was it Porfirio Diaz who said, poor Mexico, so far from God, so near to the United States. You can say that for a lot of Latin American countries, and of course one of the we know from what Trump has lately said that the, you know, he says the ICE raids are going to begin. Whatever we think of as our immigration, migration, refugee crisis at the border right now, once again, that's a function of the failure of American foreign policy, is it not?
It's certainly related. It's certainly related. And, you know, I'm not a Central America, Latin America expert, so, I couldn't talk at great detail about that. But there is definitely, we are definitely part of the story in some of the problems that some of these regions have been having. And it's a reminder, again, about humility in foreign policy, that we need to be more careful about getting tangled up in other countries' internal politics, about using force abroad, because these things can have long-term consequences that end up coming back to bite us.
So, structurally, where and how does the John Quincy Adams Society do its work?
So we have really two main avenues of approach. One is we have a professional network in Washington, D.C. The other is our campus chapters at around 44 campuses around the country. And what we are doing is educating people, equipping them intellectually, and helping them mobilize professionally to impact the foreign policy dialogue in this country and to reach positions of influence in foreign policy so that we can have a more restrained foreign policy actually be put into effect.
So do you have online resources for people who want to become more more well-versed in foreign policy issues?
Absolutely, yeah. So, if you go to our website, jqas.org, we have a newsletter that comes out every week that has a roundup of events that have been happening in the foreign policy sphere. It also, since we have that professional development angle, it has jobs and internships that are opening up at typically at early career levels in the foreign policy space. We have a list of books that we've recommended, and we have a tool called Learning Modules that we built for our campus chapters to give them some really meaty, ideas-based, discussion-based tools to have a rich conversation and a critical conversation about our foreign policy of the last few decades.
If you could have your fondest wish in this area, American foreign policy, what would it look like? What would it sound like?
Yeah, I think it would sound a lot like the speech John Quincy Adams gave in 1821, where, we are the well-wisher to the freedom and independence of all, the champion and vindicator only of our own. We go not abroad in search of monsters to destroy.
That really has stood the test of time, hasn't it?
Absolutely.
John Ellen Gay, thank you very kindly. I appreciate it. Best of luck to you and all the people who work with you at the John Quincy Adams Society. Thanks for coming by. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you, Bob.
With me now here at the Horn Table on Radio Row at Netroots Nation 2019 here in Philadelphia, from National Nurses United, I have a pair of organizers and spokespeople for Medicare for All. We will talk first with Ryan Skolnick from National Nurses United. After that, Max Cottrell will have a few things to say. We'll start with the policy stuff, Ryan. Again, first of all, let me thank you for making time to come by. I really appreciated it because I wanted very badly to have a discussion about the future of Medicare for All and how we get to that point. I'm very much an advocate for it. Let's start out with a basic question. there's a lot of talk about it. Various politicians have various plans. Are y'all behind one plan over another, or one politician's idea over another?
So Medicare for All, there's a lot of misinformation about what Medicare for All actually is. It's not a range of ideas or a spectrum. It's a specific plan. It's the Medicare for All Act in the House and Senate, H.R. 1384 and S. 1129. It is a single-payer health care system where everyone is enrolled in the same insurance plan provided publicly by the government that covers all needed care, including dental and vision, hearing, long-term care, reproductive care, with no premiums, copays, or deductibles. Anything else, there's a ton of other plans out there, none of them are Medicare for All, and we're squarely behind single-payer health care.
Okay, and so the bill that you referenced, is that the one that was introduced by Representative Jayapal?
Yes, Representative Jayapal and Debbie Dingell are the two primary authors of the bill. Senator Sanders has his own in the Senate, which is very similar, but there are some differences between them, but ultimately, that's what we're pursuing, is single-payer health care.
Okay, so if by some miracle they were to both pass, then they would go to a conference committee and we'd hammer out the differences there.
Exactly.
One of the things I despise about the way that this gets messaged on in the multimillionaire for-profit media is that there's always a discussion of cost in terms of dollars, but never a discussion of cost in terms of human life and human dignity and human health and human worth. Can you address that?
Yeah, so there's two parts to that. The first part is that the cost argument is nonsense at a factual level because our current system costs more than Medicare for All would. Even the Mercatus Institute, which is a Koch brothers-founded libertarian institute when they evaluated Medicare for All, found that it would save trillions over a decade. So it's not a matter of raising more money. It's a matter of shifting the cost burden from private for-profit companies that are preying on innocent people who need care to a nonprofit government system. So the entire premise is false, but even going beyond that, even if it did cost more, which it wouldn't under any measure, it still is a matter of we need to be willing to invest in our people's health. If we truly consider healthcare a right, as a lot of these people like to claim, then you don't allow cost to be the determinant of whether someone deserves healthcare or not.
Or whether they live or die.
Exactly.
I mean, ultimately, it is an existential crisis healthcare in the United States. Just so you can know in terms of a little bit of background, again, I have real problems with the multimillionaire for-profit media because most of those people do not live the reality of the average American on the ground. I'm one of those people. I'm one of the millions of uninsured Americans. I've got pre-existing conditions and chronic health conditions, and I don't get to go to the doctor when I'm sick unless I pay cash on the barrel head. Like I said, I'm deeply invested in the success of your effort. Let's talk a little bit from a policy perspective about how we achieve the coverage and what kind of coverage there is. Is there vision? Is there dental? Is there podiatric care for people with diabetes? Things like that.
All of those things are mentioned as explicit rights to care within the bill. So this is a common mistake that people make when thinking of Medicare for All. They think we're just taking Medicare as it is and making it available to everyone. No. It's the expanded and improved Medicare for All Act because we add dental coverage, we add vision coverage, we add hearing aids, we add long-term care, we add comprehensive reproductive care as a right. We include essentially everything that any reasonable person could define as necessary care. The only things you're not going to see covered are things like Botox injections that no insurance plan would cover currently anyway. But if it's needed for your health and well-being, it will be covered.
How about reproductive? Let's delve into reproductive care for the purpose of discussing a woman's right to choose.
So nothing goes further than Medicare for All as in terms of health overhaul, in terms of protecting women's right to choose. Not only does it guarantee full reproductive coverage, it essentially repeals the Hyde Amendment, which is the amendment that prohibits federal funding of abortion. So abortion would be covered under Medicare for All. And another thing that it does is it essentially preempts a lot of versions of trap laws. Trap laws are what conservative states use to force abortion clinics to shut down. This bill makes it to where states can't raise standards to the point where it decreases access to care. So states will no longer have the right to do things like say, we don't like this L shape of your clinic, so we're going to shut it down. So it protect...
The madness that went on in Missouri.
Exactly. And, that's not going to be a thing under Medicare for All. So it truly guarantees comprehensive reproductive care at every point as a right.
I noticed that one of the talking points that seems to be being bandied about is... And since you aren't just advocate, you're union members, okay? Y'all are organized labor. You're a strong, profound union in the United States. But I keep hearing this argument, well, you're going to take health care away from hardworking union men and women, and they're not going to want to give up their health care. Can you take a run at that, please?
Of course. So ask anyone who's ever bargained for a contract what the number one depressor of wages is. Healthcare costs, the skyrocketing costs of premiums. So one of the major reasons that there's such a massive levels of income stagnation is people are paying so much money on health insurance, and that applies to union members too. Union wages aren't growing very quickly because healthcare costs are skyrocketing so much. You remove healthcare from the negotiating table, and because they're guaranteed as a right, now you have more room not only to negotiate for higher wages, but for better working conditions and a whole other bunch of things too. So union members in particular stand to benefit a ton by the transition to Medicare for All.
Oh, and how do we, because this has been ever since the, and I don't call them debates, I call them pageants, ever since the pageants of a couple of weeks ago, with the hand raising and all that foolishness, we've had discussion of, you know, well, you're just going to do away with the insurance industry. From a practical standpoint, because it seems to me that if you think like, you know, beehives, insurance executives are drones. They don't actually do any work. They just consume. How do you get rid of that class of executives that I consider to be predatory?
So you're not going to be able to outright say, and this is where a lot of people get confused, we're banning the right of private insurance to exist. But what you can do, and what Medicare for All does, is say private insurance can exist, but it cannot offer any benefit that the public plan does. And since the public plan covers everything essential, private insurance is relegated to covering things that aren't really coverable to begin with. No one's going to pay insurance for a one-off procedure like a Botox injection. They're just going to pay out up front with it. So what you do is you prohibit them from competing with the government for essential care. So you've eliminated that profit incentive for care people need. And it has to be done that way. You can't go a middle ground like a public option or whatever, because it leaves these vultures in our system. And as we've seen through Medicare Advantage, the privatization of Medicare, as you've seen from private insurance creeping into the Medicaid system through different types of contracting that way, if you allow private insurance to continue to exist within necessary care, it's going to eat away at any public system, so they need to be excluded.
And by the way, Medicare for All will, and I don't think this is a bad thing, I think it's a good thing, Medicare for All will essentially do away with Medicaid, will it not?
Yes. So the main bill in the House that we're behind, which is H.R. 1384, essentially reassigns all Medicaid coverages, like long-term care, everything there. All of it becomes part of one single plan that everyone's a part of. And that makes sense, because you can't feasibly have a program dedicated solely for the poor without it becoming a massive target of cuts, as we've seen by Republicans.
Well, and also an opportunity for shame.
Yes, exactly. So people are often afraid to go in and show their Medicaid card from wherever it comes from because they're embarrassed. And that's many things that deters people, especially people of color, from getting the care they need. So it's a discriminatory practice in its own right.
How about pharmaceuticals?
So what the bill does with pharmaceuticals is it establishes a drug formulary based on the average price of what most other developed countries in terms of healthcare pay. And then it goes further saying that if pharma refuses to accept those prices, government gets the right to acquire the patents needed to manufacture generic versions of the drugs themselves.
And there are instances where the government already owns the patent, are there not?
Yep. So either they accept the price that we tell them to take, or we'll produce our own medicine at a substantially cheaper cost, so they have no choice in the matter.
I try to think in terms of the issues that will make the right wing you know, tear at their hair and run around screaming in the yard. What about care for, say, because we've seen it manifested in the Pentagon. What about care for trans people?
That would be covered under reproductive care, so hormone therapy, transitional therapy, all of that is fully covered. And you shouldn't apologize for that kind of thing at all.
No, I don't think so either, but I can already hear the shrieking and visualize.
They're going to shriek about anything.
They're going to shriek one way or the other.
So we don't apologize and we don't back down. If we believe healthcare is a right, that includes people, that includes trans people, that includes the undocumented. We don't allow anyone in this country, no matter who they are, to be, go without healthcare. That's what healthcare is a right.
I've mentioned in a couple of the conversations that I've had here that I call it the big healthcare lie. I saw it repeated yesterday morning on Morning Joe, where he said anybody can have coverage in this country at any time. All you have to do is walk into the ER, and they can't turn you away. Well, as an uninsured, I know what actually happens in there, and it's called stabilization. It's not called curing or treatment or fixing. Can you deconstruct that myth as well, please?
So there's two parts that go into that. First is the obvious one, which is emergency care is way more expensive. For people who like to shriek and moan about government about their tax dollars going to pay for other people's health care, that's literally what the emergency room is, except it's substantially more expensive to care for people that way. So it's funny that people talk about that. But going to the actual care aspect, when people go to the emergency room, they do get that stabilization treatment. If they're having a seizure, they'll be brought in and stabilized in critical care. And then what? You don't get long-term care. You don't get preventative care. So what ends up happening is you leave the ER, and then something else happens. You go back to the ER, but since the root cause of whatever it is isn't treated, you're more likely to have to go back again and repeat the process, all on taxpayer dime, by the way.
Let me ask you, what about the people who say, well, okay, maybe we can't have Medicare for all, but why? Maybe we should talk about a public option, because I rode that merry-go-round, you know, with the Affordable Care Act too. Is there any sort of hybrid system that is not going to continue to perpetuate this out spiral of worsening costs?
So if there is, it's not going to be any easier. In fact, I'd argue it'd be harder to get to than single payer. And here's what I mean. There's two different problems with the public option / buy-in / hybrid system argument. The first being, it won't be any easier politically to do it. The insurance and drug companies have already basically said that any expansion of government care is the same thing as Medicare for all to them, and they hate it all. So they're going to fight just as hard. We've seen in California, back in 2016, $118 million spent by drug companies to kill a ballot proposition that would have implemented one cost control on drug prices. So they're going to go all out to kill anything we do, so it won't be any easier. So there's no point in pursuing less. But on top of that, a public option is just bad policy. Because what happens when you have a public option is private insurance is going to price all the sick out of the market with things like restrictive formularies and really narrow networks. And what's going to happen then is either the public option does the same thing to keep costs low, in which case that defeats the point, or it absorbs all those sick people, and now the public option's costs continue to skyrocket because the sickest and most costly people to care for are all in the public option. So it goes into a death spiral. That's why the CBO predicted in two different studies that either, one, it's going to cost more than private insurance, or two, it's not even going to expand the number of people who are covered. So it's not only going to be just as hard, but it's not even a good idea. So we should just get rid. We shouldn't even be debating it because it's not good policy. Medicare for all is good policy.
What happens in terms of current events? We know that down in New Orleans, they recently argued in front of the Fifth Circuit in support of that federal judge's ruling from Texas to the extent that the Affordable Care Act is unconstitutional. What happens to this fight for Medicare for all? I'd give 50-50 odds on it getting up there to Kavanaugh and Gorsuch and that gang, and them putting together five votes to say that, yes, 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 the Affordable Care Act is unconstitutional. What happens to the fight for Medicare for all if that happens? Or what happens if the ACA is left stand?
So in terms of an implementation, it's harder to implement single payer with the ACA gone because there's already a lot of public money out there in the form of subsidies that just need to be rerouted. There's some structural things that we can take advantage of. So in terms of implementation, it actually becomes more difficult if the ACA is repealed. But also, there's a reason why a lot of the single-payer proponents out there, including Bernie Sanders, were the strongest defenders of the ACA when they were trying to repeal it. Because, one, it's, even though it's not a good system, it's better than the Wild Wild West we had before, and it shouldn't be repealed unless it's being replaced with single-payer at the moment. But also, and this is another major issue, people are going to be much more willing to accept a lesser half measure. They'll take anything and anything once the ACA is gone. It'll be a panic mode. Oh, no, we need to pass a stabilizing bill immediately.
Yeah, and because I saw Mitch McConnell run out and say, we will act in a bipartisan fashion to protect pre-existing conditions.
So the ACA should absolutely not be repealed. I'm hoping that the courts strike down the case against it and allow it to stand, which seems to be what a lot of even conservative lawyers are saying right now. But our focus is primarily on pushing for Medicare for All no matter what happens, because whether the ACA is there or not, obviously it's better if it is, but it's still not a universal health care system, let alone a good universal health care system.
Ryan so Skolnick, thank you very, very much. Now we'll pass the headphones and pass the microphone and talk a little bit with Max Cottrell about organizing around the around Medicare for All. Thanks, Max. Nice to talk to you.
Thanks for having us.
It is an absolute pleasure. It really, really is. One of the things that occurred to me is that with the original decision about the ACA, and I've argued for a long time that it was pure evil genius on the part of John Roberts to say the ACA can stand, but we're gonna kill the mandatory Medicaid expansion. You cannot force states to take free money, which just please. But that's where we stand. In terms of an organizing principle, Medicare for All is really the only way to close that gap of uninsured Americans in, for all intents and purposes, the modern Confederacy, isn't it?
Yeah. And, you know, when we go out there and do this organizing, we see again and again that Medicare for All is incredibly, incredibly popular. It doesn't matter what state we're working in, if we're in a conservative community or a deep blue community, Medicare for All is wildly popular. And like you said, it's the only thing that will cover everybody in this country.
Are you working in the so-called red states?
Yeah, we are organizing wherever there are people who are interested in working with us. We've had a kind of multi-pronged effort. We're working both on lobbying representatives, but also building grassroots power. So we're training folks to go out in their communities and knock on doors and have conversations with their neighbors about Medicare for All and how we move forward and how we pressure representatives to get on board. And we're doing that in all states. And even in deep red states, people are getting like I said, great feedback. And poll after poll shows that even a majority of Republicans support it, which a lot of people find hard to believe. But when you go out and knock on doors, even in conservative communities, you can definitely feel it.
What about inside American industry? It strikes me that, for instance, if you're GM and you're building cars and you're competing with, I don't know, Volkswagen, Porsche, Audi.
Yeah.
And the people at Volkswagen, Porsche, Audi, or Toyota, whatever, overseas, their workers have health care, and you, on the other hand, have to pay for yours. Are you having any success making the argument for Medicare for All with American industry?
Yeah, absolutely. I think what we have is not so much of a healthcare system, but just an ongoing healthcare crisis, and businesses are definitely feeling a significant part of that. I can't remember the exact stat, but there's a each car. I think GM quoted this the other day, and they said each car that's produced costs $2,000 or $3,000 per car in terms of the costs of healthcare to their employees, which is a huge disadvantage when they're competing with industries in other countries that have universal healthcare. I also think that, like Ryan said, I have to really underline his point, which is that for workers, the number one issue at the bargaining table is healthcare, and being able to pass Medicare for All and provide that is not only going to be a huge boon to workers, but also to businesses.
Okay, so you're both nurses. Obviously, you're working inside the healthcare community. What has been the response of organizations like the AMA?
The AMA is still opposed to Medicare for All, though the tides are starting to turn. Recently, the AMA had their national convention in Chicago, and there was a resolution to essentially withdraw the organization's opposition of Medicare for All, and it very, very narrowly was defeated by, I believe it was about less than 5%. So there is a lot of organizing being done on that front as well, but there's still obviously a lot of work to do.
So what is the nature of their objection? Are they just afraid that they're not going to continue to be filthy rich? Or, do they hide their concerns about their income behind pretended concerns about quality of care?
You know, I think, they throw up a lot of different reasons for it. I think ultimately what it gets down to is they're quite cozy with industry, and obviously in an environment where industry is continuing to just make billions and billions of dollars in profit, they're going to be doing anything and everything that they can to oppose it.
So, in terms of ordinary workaday Americans, mm-hmm. Where do we stand in this struggle in terms of approval, disapproval?
Yeah, like I said earlier, the approval of Medicare for All is at an all-time high, even amidst a wave of money coming in from industry. There's the Partnership for America's Healthcare Future, which is a front group that's basically been formed by industry and is spending millions of dollars lobbying Congress and attacking members who they think are going to come on board with Medicare for All. And despite that, public opinion and public approval of Medicare for All remains sky high. And that's, again, across ideological differences. And I think that speaks to the scale of the healthcare crisis. And I think people ultimately know that the scale of our crisis has to be met with a solution of equal scale. And they're ready to move forward and actually guarantee healthcare. And they know that we can do it. And other countries have done it. And we can save significant amounts of money in the process.
Where does the bill stand relative to co-sponsors in the House?
Yeah, we've had a lot of momentum. Just in the last week, we've had three additional co-sponsors. So we are now up to, including the bill's authors, we are up to 118. And so we're actually just about to pass a majority of Democrats in the House being signed onto the bill, which is far greater than any of the other healthcare bills, a very clear symbol of the momentum we have. We also, historically this year, as you probably know, we're able to get the first three hearings ever on Medicare for All in the House, in the Ways and Means Committee, the Budget Committee, and the Rules Committee. We're still pushing for a hearing in the last so-called Committee of Jurisdiction, the Energy and Commerce Committee.
I was going to say, how many committees is it referenced to?
It's referenced right now to three, I believe. Gave us an additional hearing in budget, but we're these are the first ever hearings on Medicare for All, so they're certainly very historic. But what we want the Democratic leadership to know is that we're not going to be satisfied with just hearings. We want this bill to be seriously considered and to be moving forward.
Sure, and I would never, based on the nature of your organization and everything, I would not ask you to endorse one candidate over another. But are within the presidential Democratic presidential field, are some candidates further along toward the idea that y'all support than others? I mean, I think obviously Bernie is because he's a co-sponsor of a Medicare for All bill in the Senate.
Right.
What about others?
Yeah, I mean, I think the presidential race has really shown how the gravity has shifted on Medicare for All. It's really clear that's the center of gravity. And as far as our union goes, we're going to have an endorsement process, obviously, and the nurses, as people who are on the front lines of the healthcare crisis every day, are not going to, I think, they're not going to settle for anything less than a champion of Medicare for All. But what we've been really, really focused on is building that movement for Medicare for All. Because we know even if we get a strong supporter of Medicare for All in the White House, they're not going to be able to pass this without a mass movement working to get it passed.
Because 20 has to be the presidency, mm-hmm. the House,
yeah.
and the Senate. And I tell people in our community to dare to dream big. Mm-hmm. It's not enough to have 51 senators.
Right.
You've got to get to 60.
Mm-hmm.
Because as long as Mitch McConnell is breathing out and breathing in again immediately thereafter, anything short of 60 mm-hmm. is going to be met with, well, he'll just say no.
Yeah. Yeah.
What about just on an individual basis, people wherever they may be, how can they get involved in this struggle?
Yeah, that's a really great question. So we are engaged in ongoing campaigns all across the country in every district. Wherever anybody is interested in working with us, we'll work with them. The easiest way to plug in would be on our website, Medicare4all.org. You can go there, sign up for our email list, join one of our teams. But we've got a lot of exciting opportunities coming up. We're just approaching the August congressional recess, where all the congressional members will be back in their districts.
Yes.
And we're working really hard to make sure that we're doing lots of events in the districts over that recess, and that they feel the pressure from their constituents and they're hearing every day from them.
I work on a bill in Congress myself, and it's related to healthcare, actually. But I always get questions like, is there any Republican out there that you think you can get on board with this?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, in terms of Republicans who have made any sort of rumblings, I don't think so. But I think that the fact that it's so popular, even among Republicans, I think that's an opportunity, and we'll have to see how that develops in the future. Because I think, you know, I think certainly a lot of the Democratic House members don't believe the polls, the approval polls on Medicare for All. So certainly the Republicans don't either. But I mean, it's really something amazing when you go out and knock on doors in a red state and you talk to people who will self-identify as lifelong Republicans and say, obviously Medicare for All is where we need to go. So I think, you know, as we get closer to actually passing this and the debate starts to heat up, I think we're going to hear a lot more from sort of rank and file Republicans, kind of agitating for this. And so I think things could get interesting.
And so people should be, as we go into the August recess, people should be on the lookout for town halls, for rallies, things like that, because y'all have those in the works?
Yeah, absolutely. We have, we're going to be having what are called people's assemblies in the districts of House members who have not yet co-sponsored. And at those events, we'll be coming together to talk about that representative, but really critically to talk about how we're going to get them on board, planning subsequent actions, rallies in their offices, legislative visits, canvasses in the communities. And then in districts where we have a supportive member, a co-sponsor, those folks are going to be holding text bank parties where they're helping text into the districts of higher priority districts to build support, find supporters, and again, just ultimately build this movement that we're going to.
So, in the red state districts, do you have pressure campaigns planned?
Oh, yeah.
Planned for that?
Yeah, absolutely. And we're, like I said, we're not even though it might be a heavy lift to get some of these Republican members to support it, that doesn't mean that we're going to be letting them off the hook. We're pressuring all and every one of them.
Well, I tell you sincerely that. I wish the very best for you, and if I can, you've got my contact. If I can be of any future help, please don't hesitate to reach out for me. Again, that's Medicare4, the numeral 4, all.org.
Yep.
Okay. And thanks again to your fantastic union for the lead that they're taking in this. Max Cottrell, thank you very kindly. Ryan Skolnick, thank you. You don't have the microphone now. I really appreciate it, because I know you've got a lot of stuff on your schedule, and I appreciate you taking time to pop by for this conversation. I really, really do. Thank you so much.
Awesome. Thanks, Bob.